as the first duty of a monk. As soon as he had received the character of deacon, Gregory was sent to reside at the Byzantine court, the nuncio or minister of the apostolic see, and he boldly assumed in the name of St. Peter a tone of independent dignity which would have been criminal and dangerous in the most illustrious layman of the empire. He returned to Rome with a just increase of reputation, and after a short exercise of the monastic virtues, he was dragged from the cloister to the papal throne by the unanimous voice of the clergy, the senate, and the people. He alone resisted, or seemed to resist, his own elevation, and his humble petition, that Maurice would be pleased to reject the choice of the Romans, could only serve to exalt his character in the eyes of the emperor and the public. When the fatal mandate was proclaimed, Gregory solicited the aid of some friendly merchants to convey him in a basket beyond the gates of Rome, and modestly concealed himself some days among the woods and mountains till his retreat was discovered, as it is said, by a celestial light. The pontificate of Gregory the Great, which lasted 13 years, 6 months, and 10 days, is one of the most edifying periods of the history of the Church. His virtues and even his faults, a singular mixture of simplicity and cunning, of pride and humility, of sense and superstition, were happily suited to his station and to the temper of the times. In his rival, the Patriarch of Constantinople, he condemned the anti-Christian title of Universal Bishop, which the successor of St. Peter was too haughty to concede and too feeble to assume. And the ecclesiastical jurisdiction of Gregory was confined to the triple character of Bishop of Rome, Primate of Italy, and Apostle of the West. He frequently ascended the pulpit, and kindled, by his rude, though pathetic, eloquence, the congenial passions of his audience. The language of the Jewish prophets was interpreted and applied, and the minds of a people depressed by their present calamities were directed to the hopes and fears of the invisible world. His precepts and example defined the model of the Roman liturgy, the distribution of the parishes, the calendar of the festivals, the order of processions, the service of the priests and deacons, the variety and change of sacerdotal garments. Till the last days of his life he officiated in the canon of the Mass, which continued above 3 hours. The Gregorian chant has preserved the vocal and instrumental music of the theatre, and the rough voices of the barbarians attempted to imitate the melody of the Roman school. Experience had shown him the efficacy of these solemn and pompous rites to soothe the distress, to confirm the faith, to mitigate the fierceness, and to dispel the dark enthusiasm of the vulgar. And he readily forgave their tendency to promote the reign of priesthood and superstition. The bishops of Italy and the adjacent islands acknowledged the Roman pontiff as their special metropolitan. Even the existence, the union, or the translation of episcopal seats was decided by his absolute discretion, and his successful inroads into the provinces of Greece, of Spain, and of Gaul might countenance the more lofty pretensions of succeeding popes. He interposed to prevent the abuses of popular elections. His jealous care maintained the purity of faith and discipline, and the apostolic shepherd assiduously watched over the faith and discipline of the subordinate pastors. Under his reign, the Arians of Italy and Spain were reconciled to the Catholic Church, and the conquest of Britain reflects less glory on the name of Caesar than on that of Gregory the First. Instead of 6 legions, 40 monks were embarked for that distant island, and the pontiff lamented the austere duties which forbade him to partake the perils of their spiritual warfare. In less than 2 years he could announce to the Archbishop of Alexandria that they had baptized the King of Kent with 10,000 of his Anglo-Saxons, and that the Roman missionaries, like those of the primitive church, were armed only with spiritual and supernatural powers. The credulity or the prudence of Gregory was always disposed to confirm the truths of religion by the evidence of ghosts, miracles, and resurrections. And posterity has paid to his memory the same tribute which he freely granted to the virtue of his own or the preceding generation. The celestial honours have been liberally bestowed by the authority of the popes, but Gregory is the last of their own order whom they have presumed to inscribe in the calendar of saints. Their temporal power insensibly arose from the calamities of the times, and the Roman bishops who have deluged Europe and Asia with blood were compelled to reign as the ministers of charity and peace. The Church of Rome, as it has been formally observed, was endowed with ample possessions in Italy, Sicily, and the more distant provinces, and her agents, who were commonly subdeacons, had acquired a civil and even criminal jurisdiction over their tenants and husbandmen. The successor of St. Peter administered his patrimony with the temper of a vigilant and moderate landlord, and the epistles of Gregory are filled with salutary instructions to abstain from doubtful or vexatious lawsuits, to preserve the integrity of weights and measures, to grant every reasonable delay, and to reduce the capitation of the slaves of the glebe, who purchased the right of marriage by the payment of an arbitrary fine. The rent or the produce of these estates was transported to the mouth of the Tiber, at the risk and expense of the Pope. In the use of wealth he acted like a faithful steward of the church and the poor, and liberally applied to their wants the inexhaustible resources of abstinence and order. The voluminous account of his receipts and disbursements were kept above 300 years in the Lateran as the model of Christian economy. On the four great festivals he divided their quarterly allowance to the clergy, to his domestics, to the monasteries, the churches, the places of burial, the almshouses, and the hospitals of Rome, and the rest of the diocese. On the first day of every month he distributed to the poor, according to the season, their stated portion of corn, wine, cheese, vegetables, oil, fish, fresh provisions, clothes, and money, and his treasurers were continually summoned to satisfy in his name the extraordinary demands of indigence and merit. The instant distress of the sick and helpless, of strangers and pilgrims, was relieved by the bounty of each day and of every hour, nor would the pontiff indulge himself in a frugal repast till he had sent the dishes from his own table to some objects deserving of his compassion. The misery of the times had reduced the nobles and matrons of Rome to accept, without a blush, the benevolence of the church. 3,000 virgins received their food and raiment from the hand of their benefactor, and many bishops of Italy escaped from the barbarians to the hospitable threshold of the Vatican. Gregory might justly be styled the father of his country, and such was the extreme sensibility of his conscience that, for the death of a beggar who had perished in the streets, he interdicted himself during several days from the exercise of sacerdotal functions. The misfortunes of Rome involved the apostolical pastor in the business of peace and war, and it might be doubtful to himself whether piety or ambition prompted him to supply the place of his absent sovereign. Gregory awakened the emperor from a long slumber, exposed the guilt or incapacity of the exarch and his inferior ministers, complained that the veterans were withdrawn from Rome for the defense of Spoleto, encouraged the Italians to guard their cities and altars, and condescended, in the crisis of danger, to name the tribunes and to direct the operations of the provincial troops. But the martial spirit of the Pope was checked by the scruples of humanity and religion. The imposition of tribute, though it was employed in the Italian war, he freely condemned as odious and oppressive, whilst he protected against the imperial edicts the pious cowardice of the soldiers who deserted a military for a monastic life. If we may credit his own declarations, it would have been easy for Gregory to exterminate the Lombards by their domestic factions without leaving a king, a duke, or a count to save that unfortunate nation from the vengeance of their foes. As a Christian bishop, he preferred the salutary offices of peace. His mediation appeased the tumult of arms, but he was too conscious of the arts of the Greeks and the passions of the Lombards to engage his sacred promise for the observance of the truce. Disappointed in the hope of a general and lasting treaty, he presumed to save his country without the consent of the emperor or the exarch. The sword of the enemy was suspended over Rome. It was averted by the mild eloquence and seasonable gifts of the pontiff, who commanded the respect of heretics and barbarians. The merits of Gregory were treated by the Byzantine court with reproach and insult. But in the attachment of a grateful people, he found the purest reward of a citizen and the best right of a sovereign. Chapter 46. Revolutions of Persia after the death of Chosroes or Nushirvan. His son Hormuz, a tyrant, is deposed. Usurpation of Bahram. Flight and restoration of Chosroes II. His gratitude to the Romans. The Chagan of the Avars. Revolt of the army against Maurice. His death. Tyranny of Phocas. Elevation of Heraclius. The Persian War. Chosroes subdues Syria, Egypt, and Asia Minor. Siege of Constantinople by the Persians and Avars. Persian expeditions. Victories and triumph of Heraclius. Part 1. The conflict of Rome and Persia was prolonged from the death of Crassus to the reign of Heraclius. An experience of 700 years might convince the rival nations of the impossibility of maintaining their conquests beyond the fatal limits of the Tigris and Euphrates. Yet the emulation of Trajan and Julian was awakened by the trophies of Alexander, and the sovereigns of Persia indulged the ambitious hope of restoring the empire of Cyrus. Such extraordinary efforts of power and courage will always command the attention of posterity. But the events by which the fate of nations is not materially changed leave a faint impression on the page of history, and the patience of the reader would be exhausted by the repetition of the same hostilities undertaken without cause, prosecuted without glory, and terminated without effect. The arts of negotiation, unknown to the simple greatness of the Senate and the Caesars, were assiduously cultivated by the Byzantine princes, and the memorials of their perpetual embassies repeat, with the same uniform prolixity, the language of falsehood and declamation, the insolence of the barbarians, and the servile temper of the tributary Greeks. Lamenting the barren superfluity of materials, I have studied to compress the narrative of these uninteresting transactions. But the just Nushirvan is still applauded as the model of Oriental kings, and the ambition of his grandson Chosroes prepared the revolution of the East, which was speedily accomplished by the arms and the religion of the successors of Muhammad. In the useless altercations that precede and justify the quarrels of princes, the Greeks and the barbarians accused each other of violating the peace which had been concluded between the two empires about 4 years before the death of Justinian. The sovereign of Persia and India aspired to reduce under his obedience the province of Yemen or Arabia Felix, the distant land of myrrh and frankincense which had escaped, rather than opposed, the conquerors of the East. After the defeat of Abraha under the walls of Mecca, the discord of his sons and brothers gave an easy entrance to the Persians. They chased the strangers of Abyssinia beyond the Red Sea, and a native prince of the ancient Homerites was restored to the throne as the vassal or viceroy of the great Nushirvan. But the nephew of Justinian declared his resolution to avenge the injuries of his Christian ally, the prince of Abyssinia, as they suggested a decent pretense to discontinue the annual tribute, which was poorly disguised by the name of pension. The churches of Persarmenia were oppressed by the intolerant spirit of the Magi. They secretly invoked the protector of the Christians, and after the pious murder of their satraps, the rebels were avowed and supported as the brethren and subjects of the Roman emperor. The complaints of Nushirvan were disregarded by the Byzantine court. Justin yielded to the importunities of the Turks, who offered an alliance against the common enemy. Then the Persian monarchy was threatened at the same instant by the united forces of Europe, of Ethiopia, and of Scythia. At the age of 80, the sovereign of the East would perhaps have chosen the peaceful enjoyment of his glory and greatness. But as soon as war became inevitable, he took the field with the alacrity of youth, whilst the aggressor trembled in the palace of Constantinople. Nushirvan, or Khosroes, conducted in person the siege of Dara, and although that important fortress had been left destitute of troops and magazines, the valor of the inhabitants resisted above 5 months the archers, the elephants, and the military engines of the great king. In the meanwhile, his general, Ahriman, advanced from Babylon, traversed the desert, passed the Euphrates, insulted the suburbs of Antioch, reduced to ashes the city of Apamea, and laid the spoils of Syria at the feet of his master, whose perseverance in the midst of winter at length subverted the bulwark of the East. But these losses, which astonished the provinces and the court, produced a salutary effect in the repentance and abdication of the Emperor Justin. A new spirit arose in the Byzantine councils, and a truce of 3 years was obtained by the prudence of Tiberius. That seasonable interval was employed in the preparations of war, and the voice of rumor proclaimed to the world that from the distant countries of the Alps and the Rhine, from Scythia, Mysia, Pannonia, Illyricum, and Isauria, the strength of the imperial cavalry was reinforced with 150,000 soldiers. Yet the king of Persia, without fear or without faith, resolved to prevent the attack of the enemy, again passed the Euphrates, and dismissing the ambassadors of Tiberius, arrogantly commanded them to await his arrival at Caesarea, the metropolis of the Cappadocian provinces. The two armies encountered each other in the Battle of Melitene. The barbarians, who darkened the air with a cloud of arrows, prolonged their line and extended their wings across the plain, while the Romans, in deep and solid bodies, expected to prevail in closer action by the weight of their swords and lances. A Scythian chief, who commanded their right wing, suddenly turned the flank of the enemy, attacked their rear guard in the presence of Khosroes, penetrated to the midst of the camp, pillaged the royal tent, profaned the eternal fire, loaded a train of camels with the spoils of Asia, cut his way through the Persian host, and returned with songs of victory to his friends, who had consumed the day in single combats or ineffectual skirmishes. The darkness of the night and the separation of the Romans afforded the Persian monarch an opportunity of revenge, and one of their camps was swept away by a rapid and impetuous assault. But the review of his losses and the consciousness of his danger determined Khosroes to a speedy retreat. He burnt in his passage the vacant town of Melitene, and, without consulting the safety of his troops, boldly swam the Euphrates on the back of an elephant. After this unsuccessful campaign, the want of magazines and perhaps some inroad of the Turks obliged him to disband or divide his forces. The Romans were left masters of the field, and their general Justinian, advancing to the relief of the Persarmenian rebels, erected his standard on the banks of the Araxes. The great Pompey had formerly halted within 3 days' march of the Caspian. That inland sea was explored for the first time by a hostile fleet, and 70,000 captives were transplanted from Hyrcania to the Isle of Cyprus. On the return of spring, Justinian descended into the fertile plains of Assyria. The flames of war approached the residence of Nushirvan. The indignant monarch sunk into the grave, and his last edict restrained his successors from exposing their person in battle against the Romans. Yet the memory of this transient affront was lost in the glories of a long reign, and his formidable enemies, after indulging their dreams of conquest, again solicited a short respite from the calamities of war. The throne of Khosroes Nushirvan was filled by Hormuz, or Hormisdas, the eldest or the most favored of his sons. With the kingdoms of Persia and India, he inherited the reputation and example of his father, the service in every rank of his wise and valiant officers, and a general system of administration, harmonized by time and political wisdom to promote the happiness of the prince and people. But the royal youth enjoyed a still more valuable blessing, the friendship of a sage who had presided over his education, and who always preferred the honor to the interest of his pupil, his interest to his inclination. In a dispute with the Greek and Indian philosophers, Buzug had once maintained that the most grievous misfortune of life is old age without the remembrance of virtue. And our candor will presume that the same principle compelled him, during 3 years, to direct the councils of the Persian Empire. His zeal was rewarded by the gratitude and docility of Hormuz, who acknowledged himself more indebted to his preceptor than to his parent. But when age and labor had impaired the strength and, perhaps, the faculties of this prudent counselor, he retired from court and abandoned the youthful monarch to his own passions and those of his favorites. By the fatal vicissitude of human affairs, the same scenes were renewed at Ctesiphon, which had been exhibited at Rome after the death of Marcus Antoninus. The ministers of flattery and corruption who had been banished by his father were recalled and cherished by the son. The disgrace and exile of the friends of Nushirvan established their tyranny, and virtue was driven by degrees from the mind of Hormuz, from his palace, and from the government of the state. The faithful agents, the eyes and ears of the king, informed him of the progress of disorder, that the provincial governors flew to their prey with the fierceness of lions and eagles, and that their rapine and injustice would teach the most loyal of his subjects to abhor the name and authority of their sovereign. The sincerity of this advice was punished with death. The murmurs of the cities were despised. Their tumults were quelled by military execution. The intermediate powers between the throne and the people were abolished, and the childish vanity of Hormuz, who affected the daily use of the tiara, was fond of declaring that he alone would be the judge as well as the master of his kingdom. In every word and in every action the son of Nushirvan degenerated from the virtues of his father. His avarice defrauded the troops, his jealous caprice degraded the satraps. The palace, the tribunals, the waters of the Tigris were stained with the blood of the innocent, and the tyrant exulted in the sufferings and execution of 13,000 victims. As the excuse of his cruelty, he sometimes condescended to observe that the fears of the Persians would be productive of hatred, and that their hatred must terminate in rebellion. But he forgot that his own guilt and folly had inspired the sentiments which he deplored, and prepared the event which he so justly apprehended. Exasperated by long and hopeless oppression, the provinces of Babylon, Susa, and Carmania erected the standard of revolt. Then the princes of Arabia, India, and Scythia refused the customary tribute to the unworthy successor of Nushirvan. The arms of the Romans, in slow sieges and frequent inroads, afflicted the frontiers of Mesopotamia and Assyria. One of their generals professed himself the disciple of Scipio, and the soldiers were animated by a miraculous image of Christ, whose mild aspect should never have been displayed in the front of battle. At the same time, the eastern provinces of Persia were invaded by the great Khan, who passed the Oxus at the head of 300,000 or 400,000 Turks. The imprudent Hormuz accepted their perfidious and formidable aid. The cities of Khorasan or Bactriana were commanded to open their gates. The march of the barbarians towards the mountains of Hyrcania revealed the correspondence of the Turkish and Roman arms, and their union must have subverted the throne of the house of Sasan. Persia had been lost by a king. It was saved by a hero. After his revolt, Varanes, or Bahram, is stigmatized by the son of Hormuz as an ungrateful slave. The proud and ambiguous reproach of despotism, since he was truly descended from the ancient princes of Re, one of the seven families whose splendid as well as substantial prerogatives exalted them above the heads of the Persian nobility. At the siege of Dara, the valor of Bahram was signalized under the eyes of Nushirvan, and both the father and son successively promoted him to the command of armies, the government of Media, and the superintendence of the palace. The popular prediction which marked him as the deliverer of Persia might be inspired by his past victories and extraordinary figure. The epithet Gyubin is expressive of the quality of dry wood. He had the strength and stature of a giant, and his savage countenance was fancifully compared to that of a wild cat. While the nation trembled, while Hormuz disguised his terror by the name of suspicion, and his servants concealed their disloyalty under the mask of fear, Bahram alone displayed his undaunted courage and apparent fidelity. And as soon as he found that no more than 12,000 soldiers would follow him against the enemy, he prudently declared that to this fatal number heaven had reserved the honors of the triumph. The steep and narrow descent of the Pule Rubba, or Hyrcanian Rock, is the only pass through which an army can penetrate into the territory of Rei and the plains of Media. From the commanding heights, a band of resolute men might overwhelm with stones and darts the myriads of the Turkish host. Their emperor and his son were transpierced with arrows, and the fugitives were left without counsel or provisions to the revenge of an injured people. The patriotism of the Persian general was stimulated by his affection for the city of his forefathers. In the hour of victory, every peasant became a soldier and every soldier a hero, and their ardor was kindled by the gorgeous spectacle of beds and thrones and tables of massy gold, the spoils of Asia, and the luxury of the hostile camp. A prince of a less malignant temper could not easily have forgiven his benefactor, and the secret hatred of Hormuz was envenomed by a malicious report that Bahram had privately retained the most precious fruits of his Turkish victory. But the approach of a Roman army on the side of the Araxes compelled the implacable tyrant to smile and to applaud, and the toils of Bahram were rewarded with the permission of encountering a new enemy by their skill and discipline more formidable than a Scythian multitude. Elated by his recent success, he dispatched a herald with a bold defiance to the camp of the Romans, requesting them to fix a day of battle and to choose whether they would pass the river themselves or allow a free passage to the arms of the great king. The lieutenant of the emperor, Maurice, preferred the safer alternative, and this local circumstance, which would have enhanced the victory of the Persians, rendered their defeat more bloody and their escape more difficult. But the loss of his subjects and the danger of his kingdom were overbalanced in the mind of Hormuz by the disgrace of his personal enemy, and no sooner had Bahram collected and reviewed his forces than he received from a royal messenger the insulting gift of a distaff, a spinning wheel, and a complete suit of female apparel. Obedient to the will of his sovereign, he showed himself to the soldiers in this unworthy disguise. They resented his ignominy and their own. A shout of rebellion ran through the ranks, and the general accepted their oath of fidelity and vows of revenge. A second messenger, who had been commanded to bring the rebel in chains, was trampled under the feet of an elephant, and manifestos were diligently circulated, exhorting the Persians to assert their freedom against an odious and contemptible tyrant. The defection was rapid and universal. His loyal slaves were sacrificed to the public fury. The troops deserted to the standard of Bahram, and the provinces again saluted the deliverer of his country. As the passes were faithfully guarded, Hormuz could only compute the number of his enemies by the testimony of a guilty conscience, and the daily defection of those who, in the hour of his distress, avenged their wrongs or forgot their obligations. He proudly displayed the ensigns of royalty, but the city and palace of Modain had already escaped from the hand of the tyrant. Among the victims of his cruelty, Bindoes, a Sasanian prince, had been cast into a dungeon. His fetters were broken by the zeal and courage of a brother, and he stood before the king at the head of those trusty guards who had been chosen as the ministers of his confinement and perhaps of his death. Alarmed by the hasty intrusion and bold reproaches of the captive, Hormuz looked round, but in vain, for advice or assistance, discovered that his strength consisted in the obedience of others, and patiently yielded to the single arm of Binduiz, who dragged him from the throne to the same dungeon in which he himself had been so lately confined. At the first tumult, Chosroes, the eldest of the sons of Hormuz, escaped from the city. He was persuaded to return by the pressing and friendly invitation of Binduiz, who promised to seat him on his father's throne, and who expected to reign under the name of an inexperienced youth. In the just assurance that his accomplices could neither forgive nor hope to be forgiven, and that every Persian might be trusted as the judge and enemy of the tyrant, he instituted a public trial without a precedent and without a copy in the annals of the East. The son of Nushirvan, who had requested to plead in his own defense, was introduced as a criminal into the full assembly of the nobles and satraps. He was heard with decent attention as long as he expatiated on the advantages of order and obedience, the danger of innovation, and the inevitable discord of those who had encouraged each other to trample on their lawful and hereditary sovereign. By pathetic appeal to their humanity, he extorted that pity which is seldom refused to the fallen fortunes of a king, and while they beheld the abject posture and squalid appearance of the prisoner, his tears, his chains, and the marks of ignominious stripes, it was impossible to forget how recently they had adored the divine splendor of his diadem and purple. But an angry murmur arose in the assembly as soon as he presumed to vindicate his conduct and to applaud the victories of his reign. He defined the duties of a king, and the Persian nobles listened with a smile of contempt. They were fired with indignation when he dared to vilify the character of Chosroes, and by the indiscreet offer of resigning the scepter to the second of his sons, he subscribed his own condemnation and sacrificed the life of his own innocent favorite. The mangled bodies of the boy and his mother were exposed to the people. The eyes of Hormuz were pierced with a hot needle, and the punishment of the father was succeeded by the coronation of his eldest son. Chosroes had ascended the throne without guilt, and his piety strove to alleviate the misery of the abdicated monarch. From the dungeon he removed Hormuz to an apartment of the palace, supplied with liberality the consolations of sensual enjoyment, and patiently endured the furious sallies of his resentment and despair. He might despise the resentment of a blind and unpopular tyrant, but the tiara was trembling on his head till he could subvert the power or acquire the friendship of the great Bahram, who sternly denied the justice of a revolution in which himself and his soldiers, the true representatives of Persia, had never been consulted. The offer of a general amnesty and of the second rank in his kingdom was answered by an epistle from Bahram, friend of the gods, conqueror of men, and enemy of tyrants, the satrap of satraps, general of the Persian armies, and a prince adorned with the title of 11 Virtues. He commands Chosroes, the son of Hormuz, to shun the example and fate of his father, to confine the traitors who had been released from their chains, to deposit in some holy place the diadem which he had usurped, and to accept from his gracious benefactor the pardon of his faults and the government of a province. The rebel might not be proud, and the king most assuredly was not humble, but the one was conscious of his strength, the other was sensible of his weakness, and even the modest language of his reply still left room for treaty and reconciliation. Chosroes led into the field the slaves of the palace and the populace of the capital. They beheld with terror the banners of a veteran army. They were encompassed and surprised by the evolutions of the general, and the satraps, who had deposed Hormuz, received the punishment of their revolt, or expiated their first treason by a second and more criminal act of disloyalty. The life and liberty of Chosroes were saved, but he was reduced to the necessity of imploring aid or refuge in some foreign land, and the implacable Bindoes, anxious to secure an unquestionable title, hastily returned to the palace and ended with a bowstring the wretched existence of the son of Nushirvan. While Chosroes dispatched the preparations of his retreat, he deliberated with his remaining friends whether he should lurk in the valleys of Mount Caucasus, or fly to the tents of the Turks, or solicit the protection of the emperor. The long emulation of the successors of Artaxerxes and Constantine increased his reluctance to appear as a suppliant in a rival court. But he weighed the forces of the Romans and prudently considered that the neighborhood of Syria would render his escape more easy and their succors more effectual. Attended only by his concubines and a troop of 30 guards, he secretly departed from the capital, followed the banks of the Euphrates, traversed the desert, and halted at the distance of 10 miles from Circesium. About the third watch of the night, the Roman prefect was informed of his approach, and he introduced the royal stranger to the fortress of the Dawn of Day. From thence, the king of Persia was conducted to the more honorable residence of Hierapolis, and Maurice dissembled his pride and displayed his benevolence at the reception of the letters and ambassadors of the grandson of Nushirvan. They humbly represented the vicissitudes of fortune and the common interest of princes, exaggerated the ingratitude of Bahram, the agent of the evil principle, and urged with specious argument that it was for the advantage of the Romans themselves to support the two monarchies which balance the world, the two great luminaries by whose salutary influence it is vivified and adorned. The anxiety of Chosroes was soon relieved by the assurance that the emperor had espoused the cause of justice and royalty. But Maurice prudently declined the expense and delay of his useless visit to Constantinople. In the name of his generous benefactor, a rich diadem was presented to the fugitive prince with an inestimable gift of jewels and gold. A powerful army was assembled on the frontiers of Syria and Armenia under the command of the valiant and faithful Narses, and this general of his own nation and his own choice was directed to pass the Tigris and never to sheathe his sword till he had restored Chosroes to the throne of his ancestors. The enterprise, however splendid, was less arduous than it might appear. Persia had already repented of her fatal rashness, which betrayed the heir of the house of Sasan to the ambition of a rebellious subject, and the bold refusal of the Magi to consecrate his usurpation compelled Bahram to assume the scepter, regardless of the laws and prejudices of the nation. The palace was soon distracted with conspiracy, the city with tumult, the provinces with insurrection, and the cruel execution of the guilty and the suspected served to irritate rather than subdue the public discontent. No sooner did the grandson of Nushirvan display his own and the Roman banners beyond the Tigris than he was joined each day by the increasing multitudes of the nobility and people. And as he advanced, he received from every side the grateful offerings of the keys of his cities and the heads of his enemies. As soon as Modane was freed from the presence of the usurper, the loyal inhabitants obeyed the first summons of Mebodes at the head of only 2,000 horse, and Chosroes accepted the sacred and precious ornaments of the palace as the pledge of their truth and the presage of his approaching success. After the junction of the imperial troops, which Bahram vainly struggled to prevent, the contest was decided by 2 battles on the banks of the Zab and the confines of Media. The Romans, with the faithful subjects of Persia, amounted to 60,000, while the whole force of the usurper did not exceed 40,000 men. The 2 generals signalized their valor and ability, but the victory was finally determined by the prevalence of numbers and discipline. With the remnant of a broken army, Bahram fled towards the eastern provinces of the Oxus. The enmity of Persia reconciled him to the Turks, but his days were shortened by poison, perhaps the most incurable of poisons. The stings of remorse and despair, and the bitter remembrance of lost glory. Yet the modern Persians still commemorate the exploits of Bahram, and some excellent laws have prolonged the duration of his troubled and transitory reign. The restoration of Khosroes was celebrated with feasts and executions, and the music of the royal banquet was often disturbed by the groans of dying or mutilated criminals. A general pardon might have diffused comfort and tranquility through a country which had been shaken by the late revolutions. Yet before the sanguinary temper of Khosroes is blamed, we should learn whether the Persians had not been accustomed either to dread the rigor or to despise the weakness of their sovereign. The revolt of Bahram and the conspiracy of the satraps were impartially punished by the revenge or justice of the conqueror. The merits of Bindaviz himself could not purify his hand from the guilt of royal blood, and the son of Hormuz was desirous to assert his own innocence and to vindicate the sanctity of kings. During the vigor of the Roman power, several princes were seated on the throne of Persia by the arms and the authority of the first Caesars, but their new subjects were soon disgusted with the vices or virtues which they had imbibed in a foreign land. The instability of their dominion gave birth to a vulgar observation that the choice of Rome was solicited and rejected with equal ardor by the capricious levity of Oriental slaves. But the glory of Maurice was conspicuous in the long and fortunate reign of his son and his ally. A band of 1,000 Romans, who continued to guard the person of Khosroes, proclaimed his confidence in the fidelity of the strangers. His growing strength enabled him to dismiss this unpopular aid, but he steadily professed the same gratitude and reverence to his adopted father, and till the death of Maurice, the peace and alliance of the two empires were faithfully maintained. Yet the mercenary friendship of the Roman prince had been purchased with costly and important gifts. The strong cities of Martyropolis and Dara were restored, and the Persarmenians became the willing subjects of an empire whose eastern limit was extended beyond the example of former times as far as the banks of the Araxes and the neighborhood of the Caspian. A pious hope was indulged that the church as well as the state might triumph in this revolution. But if Khosroes had sincerely listened to the Christian bishops, the impression was erased by the zeal and eloquence of the Magi. If he was armed with philosophic indifference, he accommodated his belief, or rather his professions, to the various circumstances of an exile and a sovereign. The imaginary conversion of the king of Persia was reduced to a local and superstitious veneration for Sergius, one of the saints of Antioch, who heard his prayers and appeared to him in dreams. He enriched the shrine with offerings of gold and silver, and described to this invisible patron the success of his arms and the pregnancy of Sira, a devout Christian and the best beloved of his wives. The beauty of Sira, or Shirin, her wit, her musical talents, are still famous in the history, or rather in the romances, of the East. Her own name is expressive in the Persian tongue of sweetness and grace, and the epithet of Parviz alludes to the charms of her royal lover. Yet Sira never shared the passions which she inspired, and the bliss of Khosroes was tortured by a jealous doubt that while he possessed her person, she had bestowed her affections on a meaner favorite. Part 2. While the majesty of the Roman name was revived in the East, the prospect of Europe is less pleasing and less glorious. By the departure of the Lombards and the ruin of the Gepidi, the balance of power was destroyed on the Danube, and the Avars spread their permanent dominion over the foot of the Alps to the seacoast of the Black Sea. The reign of Baian is the brightest era of their monarchy. Their Chagan, who occupied the rustic palace of Attila, appears to have imitated his character and policy. But as the same scenes were repeated in a smaller circle, a minute representation of the copy would be devoid of the greatness and novelty of the original. The pride of the second Justin, of Tiberius and Maurice, was humbled by a proud barbarian, more prompt to inflict than exposed to suffer the injuries of war. And as often as Asia was threatened by the Persian arms, Europe was oppressed by the dangerous inroads or costly friendship of the Avars. When the Roman envoys approached the presence of the Chagan, they were commanded to wait at the door of his tent, till at the end, perhaps of 10 or 12 days, he condescended to admit them. If the substance or the style of their message was offensive to his ear, he insulted with real or affected fury their own dignity and that of their prince. Their baggage was plundered, and their lives were only saved by the promise of a richer present and a more respectful address. But his sacred ambassadors enjoyed and abused an unbounded license in the midst of Constantinople. They urged with importunate clamors the increase of tribute, or the restitution of captives and deserters, and the majesty of the empire was almost equally degraded by base compliance or by the false and fearful excuses with which they eluded such insolent demands. The Chagan had never seen an elephant, and his curiosity was excited by the strange and perhaps fabulous portrait of that wonderful animal. At his command, one of the largest elephants of the imperial stables was equipped with stately caparisons and conducted by a numerous train to the royal village in the plains of Hungary. He surveyed the enormous beast with surprise, with disgust, and possibly with terror, and smiled at the vain industry of the Romans, who in search of such useless rarities could explore the limits of the land and sea. He wished at the expense of the emperor to repose in a golden bed. The wealth of Constantinople and the skillful diligence of her artists were instantly devoted to the gratification of his caprice. But when the work was finished, he rejected with scorn a present so unworthy the majesty of a great king. These were the casual sallies of his pride. But the avarice of the Chagan was a more steady and tractable passion. A rich and regular supply of silk apparel, furniture, and plate introduced the rudiments of art and luxury among the tents of the Scythians. Their appetite was stimulated by the pepper and cinnamon of India. The annual subsidy or tribute was raised from 80,000 to 120,000 pieces of gold. And after each hostile interruption, the payment of the arrears with exorbitant interest was always made the first condition of the new treaty. In the language of a barbarian, without guile, the prince of the Avars affected to complain of the insincerity of the Greeks. Yet he was not inferior to the most civilized nations in the refinement of dissimulation and perfidy. As the successor of the Lombards, the Chagan asserted his claim to the important city of Sirmium, the ancient bulwark of the Illyrian provinces. The plains of the Lower Hungary were covered with the Avar horse, and a fleet of large boats was built in the Hercynian wood to descend the Danube and to transport into the Save the materials of a bridge. But as the strong garrison of Singidunum, which commanded the conflux of the two rivers, might have stopped their passage and baffled his designs, he dispelled their apprehensions by a solemn oath that his views were not hostile to the empire. He swore by his sword, the symbol of the god of war, that he did not, as the enemy of Rome, construct a bridge upon the Save. "If I violate my oath," pursued the intrepid Baian, "may I myself and the last of my nation perish by the sword. May the heavens and fire, the deity of the heavens, fall upon our heads. May the forests and mountains bury us in their ruins, and the Save, returning against the laws of nature to his source, overwhelm us in his angry waters." After this barbarous imprecation, he calmly inquired what oath was most sacred and venerable among the Christians, what guilt or perjury it was most dangerous to incur. The bishop of Singidunum presented the gospel, which the Chagan received with devout reverence. "I swear," said he, "by the God who has spoken in this holy book, that I have neither falsehood on my tongue nor treachery in my heart." As soon as he rose from his knees, he accelerated the labor of the bridge and dispatched an envoy to proclaim what he no longer wished to conceal. "Inform the emperor," said the perfidious Baian, "that Sirmium is invested on every side. advise his prudence to withdraw the citizens and their effects, and to resign a city which it is now impossible to relieve or defend. Without the hope of relief, the defense of Sirmium was prolonged above 3 years. The walls were still untouched, but famine was enclosed within the walls, till a merciful capitulation allowed the escape of the naked and hungry inhabitants. Singidunum, at the distance of 50 miles, experienced a more cruel fate. The buildings were razed, and the vanquished people was condemned to servitude and exile. Yet the ruins of Sirmium are no longer visible. The advantageous situation of Singidunum soon attracted a new colony of Sclavonians, and the conflux of the Save and Danube is still guarded by the fortifications of Belgrade, or the White City, so often and so obstinately disputed by the Christian and Turkish arms. From Belgrade to the walls of Constantinople, a line may be measured of 600 miles. That line was marked with flames and with blood. The horses of the Avars were alternately bathed in the Black Sea and the Adriatic, and the Roman pontiff, alarmed by the approach of a more savage enemy, was reduced to cherish the Lombards as the protectors of Italy. The despair of a captive whom his country refused to ransom disclosed to the Avars the invention and practice of military engines. But in the first attempts they were rudely framed and awkwardly managed, and the resistance of Diocletianopolis and Berea, of Philippopolis and Adrianople, soon exhausted the skill and patience of the besiegers. The warfare of Baian was that of a Tartar, yet his mind was susceptible of a humane and generous sentiment. He spared Anchialus, whose salutary waters had restored the health of the best-beloved of his wives, and the Romans confessed that their starving army was fed and dismissed by the liberality of a foe. His empire extended over Hungary, Poland, and Prussia, from the mouth of the Danube to that of the Oder, and his new subjects were divided and transplanted by the jealous policy of the conqueror. The eastern regions of Germany, which had been left vacant by the emigration of the Vandals, were replenished with Sclavonian colonists. The same tribes are discovered in the neighborhood of the Adriatic and of the Baltic, and with the name of Baian himself, the Illyrian cities of Nice and Lissa are again found in the heart of Silesia. In the disposition both of his troops and provinces, the Chagan exposed the vassals, whose lives he disregarded, to the first assault, and the swords of the enemy were blunted before they encountered the native valor of the Avars. The Persian alliance restored the troops of the East to the defense of Europe, and Maurice, who had supported 10 years the insolence of the Chagan, declared his resolution to march in person against the barbarians. In the space of 2 centuries, none of the successors of Theodosius had appeared in the field. Their lives were supinely spent in the palace of Constantinople, and the Greeks could no longer understand the name of emperor in its primitive sense, denoted the chief of the armies of the Republic. The martial ardor of Maurice was opposed by the grave flattery of the Senate, the timid superstition of the Patriarch, and the tears of the Empress Constantina. And they all conjured him to devolve on some meaner general the fatigues and perils of a Scythian campaign. Deaf to their advice and entreaty, the emperor boldly advanced 7 miles from the capital. The sacred ensign of the cross was displayed in the front, and Maurice reviewed, with conscious pride, the arms and numbers of the veterans who had fought and conquered beyond the Tigris. Anchialus was the last term of his progress by sea and land. He solicited, without success, a miraculous answer to his nocturnal prayers. His mind was confounded by the death of a favorite horse, the encounter of a wild boar, a storm of wind and rain, and the birth of a monstrous child. And he forgot that the best of omens is to unsheathe our sword in the defense of our country. Under the pretense of receiving the ambassadors of Persia, the emperor returned to Constantinople, exchanged the thoughts of war for those of devotion, and disappointed the public hope by his absence and the choice of his lieutenants. The blind partiality of fraternal love might excuse the promotion of his brother Peter, who fled with equal disgrace from the barbarians, from his own soldiers, and from the inhabitants of a Roman city. That city, if we may credit the resemblance of name and character, was the famous Azimontium, which had alone repelled the tempest of Attila. The example of her warlike youth was propagated to succeeding generations, and they obtained, from the first or the second Justin, an honourable privilege that their valour should be always reserved for the defence of their native country. The brother of Maurice attempted to violate this privilege and to mingle a patriot band with the mercenaries of his camp. They retired to the church. He was not awed by the sanctity of the place. The people rose in their cause, the gates were shut, the ramparts were manned, and the cowardice of Peter was found equal to his arrogance and injustice. The military fame of Comantiolus is the object of satire or comedy rather than of serious history, since he was even deficient in the vile and vulgar qualification of personal courage. His solemn counsels, strange evolutions, and secret orders always supplied an apology for flight or delay. If he marched against the enemy, the pleasant valleys of Mount Hemus opposed an insuperable barrier. But in his retreat, he explored with fearless curiosity the most difficult and obsolete paths, which had almost escaped the memory of the oldest native. The only blood which he lost was drawn in a real or affected malady by the lancet of a surgeon, and his health, which felt with exquisite sensibility the approach of the barbarians, was uniformly restored by the repose and safety of the winter season. A prince who could promote and support this unworthy favourite must derive no glory from the accidental merit of his colleague Priscus. In 5 successive battles, which seem to have been conducted with skill and resolution, 17,200 barbarians were made prisoners. Near 60,000, with 4 sons of the Chagan, were slain. The Roman general surprised a peaceful district of the Gepidi, who slept under the protection of the Avars, and his last trophies were erected on the banks of the Danube and the Theiss. Since the death of Trajan, the arms of the empire had not penetrated so deeply into the old Dacia. Yet the success of Priscus was transient and barren, and he was soon recalled by the apprehension that Baian, with dauntless spirit and recruited forces, was preparing to avenge his defeat under the walls of Constantinople. The theory of war was not more familiar to the camps of Caesar and Trajan than to those of Justinian and Maurice. The iron of Tuscany or Pontus still received the keenest temper from the skill of the Byzantine workmen. The magazines were plentifully stored with every species of offensive and defensive arms. In the construction and use of ships, engines, and fortifications, the barbarians admired the superior ingenuity of a people whom they had so often vanquished in the field. The science of tactics, the order, evolutions, and stratagems of antiquity was transcribed and studied in the books of the Greeks and Romans. But the solitude or degeneracy of the provinces could no longer supply a race of men to handle those weapons, to guard those walls, to navigate those ships, and to reduce the theory of war into bold and successful practice. The genius of Belisarius and Narses had been formed without a master, and expired without a disciple. Neither honour, nor patriotism, nor generous superstition could animate the lifeless bodies of slaves and strangers, who had succeeded to the honours of the legions. It was in the camp alone that the emperor should have exercised a despotic command. It was only in the camps that his authority was disobeyed and insulted. He appeased and inflamed with gold the licentiousness of the troops. But their vices were inherent, their victories were accidental, and their costly maintenance exhausted the substance of a state which they were unable to defend. After a long and pernicious indulgence, the cure of this inveterate evil was undertaken by Maurice. But the rash attempt, which drew destruction on his own head, tended only to aggravate the disease. A reformer should be exempt from the suspicion of interest, and he must possess the confidence and esteem of those whom he proposes to reclaim. The troops of Maurice might listen to the voice of a victorious leader. They disdain the admonitions of statesmen and sophists, and when they received an edict which deducted from their pay the price of their arms and clothing, they execrated the avarice of a prince insensible of the dangers and fatigues from which he had escaped. The camps both of Asia and Europe were agitated with frequent and furious seditions. The enraged soldiers of Edessa pursued with reproaches, with threats, with wounds, their trembling generals. They overturned the statues of the emperor, cast stones against the miraculous image of Christ, and either rejected the yoke of all civil and military laws, or instituted a dangerous model of voluntary subordination. The monarch, always distant and often deceived, was incapable of yielding or persisting according to the exigence of the moment. But the fear of a general revolt induced him too readily to accept any act of valor or any expression of loyalty as an atonement for the popular offense. The new reform was abolished as hastily as it had been announced, and the troops, instead of punishment and restraint, were agreeably surprised by a gracious proclamation of immunities and rewards. But the soldiers accepted without gratitude the tardy and reluctant gifts of the emperor. Their insolence was elated by the discovery of his weakness and their own strength, and their mutual hatred was inflamed beyond the desire of forgiveness or the hope of reconciliation. The historians of the times adopt the vulgar suspicion that Maurice conspired to destroy the troops whom he had labored to reform. The misconduct and favor of Commentiolus are imputed to this malevolent design, and every age must condemn the inhumanity of avarice of a prince who, by the trifling ransom of 6,000 pieces of gold, might have prevented the massacre of 12,000 prisoners in the hands of the Chagan. In the just fervor of indignation, an order was signified to the army of the Danube that they should spare the magazines of the province and establish their winter quarters in the hostile country of the Avars. The measure of their grievances was full. They pronounced Maurice unworthy to reign, expelled or slaughtered his faithful adherents, and under the command of Phocas, a simple centurion, returned by hasty marches to the neighborhood of Constantinople. After a long series of legal succession, the military disorders of the 3rd century were again revived. Yet such was the novelty of the enterprise that the insurgents were awed by their own rashness. They hesitated to invest their favorite with the vacant purple, and while they rejected all treaty with Maurice himself, they held a friendly correspondence with his son Theodosius and with Germanus, the father-in-law of the royal youth. So obscure had been the former condition of Phocas that the emperor was ignorant of the name and character of his rival. But as soon as he learned that the centurion, though bold in sedition, was timid in the face of danger, "Alas," cried the desponding prince, "if he is a coward, he will surely be a murderer." Yet if Constantinople had been firm and faithful, the murderer might have spent his fury against the walls, and the rebel army would have been gradually consumed or reconciled by the prudence of the emperor. In the games of the circus, which he repeated with unusual pomp, Maurice disguised, with smiles of confidence, the anxiety of his heart, condescended to solicit the applause of the factions, and flattered their pride by accepting from their respective tribunes a list of 900 blues and 1,500 greens, whom he affected to esteem as the solid pillars of his throne. Their treacherous or languid support betrayed his weakness and hastened his fall. The green faction were the secret accomplices of the rebels, and the blues recommended lenity and moderation in a contest with their Roman brethren. The rigid and parsimonious virtues of Maurice had long since alienated the hearts of his subjects. As he walked barefoot in a religious procession, he was rudely assaulted with stones, and his guards were compelled to present their iron maces in the defense of his person. A fanatic monk ran through the streets with a drawn sword, denouncing against him the wrath and the sentence of God, and a vile plebeian who represented his countenance and apparel was seated on an ass, and pursued by the imprecations of the multitude. The emperor suspected the popularity of Germanus with the soldiers and citizens. He feared, he threatened, but he delayed to strike. The patrician fled to the sanctuary of the church. The people rose in his defense. The walls were deserted by the guards, and the lawless city was abandoned to the flames and rapine of a nocturnal tumult. In a small bark, the unfortunate Maurice, with his wife and 9 children, escaped to the Asiatic shore, but the violence of the wind compelled him to land at the church of St. Autonomous, near Chalcedon, from whence he dispatched Theodosius, his eldest son, to implore the gratitude and friendship of the Persian monarch. For himself he refused to fly. His body was tortured with sciatic pains. His mind was enfeebled by superstition. He patiently awaited the event of the revolution, and addressed a fervent and public prayer to the Almighty, that the punishment of his sins might be inflicted in this world rather than in a future life. After the abdication of Maurice, the 2 factions disputed the choice of an emperor, but the favorite of the Blues was rejected by the jealousy of their antagonists, and Germanus himself was hurried along by the crowds who rushed to the palace of Hebdomon, 7 miles from the city, to adore the majesty of Phocas the centurion. A modest wish of resigning the purple to the rank and merit of Germanus was opposed by his resolution, more obstinate and equally sincere. The Senate and clergy obeyed his summons, and as soon as the patriarch was assured of his orthodox belief, he consecrated the successful usurper in the church of St. John the Baptist. On the 3rd day, amidst the acclamations of a thoughtless people, Phocas made his public entry in a chariot drawn by 4 white horses. The revolt of the troops was rewarded by a lavish donative, and the new sovereign, after visiting the palace, beheld from his throne the games of the hippodrome. In a dispute of presidency between the 2 factions, his partial judgment inclined in favor of the Greens. "Remember that Maurice is still alive," resounded from the opposite side, and the indiscreet clamor of the Blues admonished and stimulated the cruelty of the tyrant. The ministers of death were dispatched to Chalcedon. They dragged the emperor from his sanctuary, and the 5 sons of Maurice were successively murdered before the eyes of their agonizing parent. At each stroke which he felt in his heart, he found strength to rehearse a pious ejaculation, "Thou art just, O Lord, and thy judgments are righteous." And such, in the last moments, was his rigid attachment to truth and justice that he revealed to the soldiers the pious falsehood of a nurse who presented her own child in the place of a royal infant. The tragic scene was finally closed by the execution of the emperor himself in the 20th year of his reign and the 63rd of his age. The bodies of the father and his 5 sons were cast into the sea. Their heads were exposed at Constantinople to the insults or pity of the multitude, and it was not till some signs of putrefaction had appeared that Phocas connived at the private burial of these venerable remains. In that grave the faults and errors of Maurice were kindly interred. His fate alone was remembered, and at the end of 20 years, in the recital of the history of Theophylact, the mournful